Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
They're still counting ballots in Iraq, but we're getting reports that it's a close race. Too close. In a country that needs decisive leadership, it appears there's a three-way split in the votes. In a country that needs a clear winner, they have ambiguity. Al Jazeera, though, says there's no chance that Nouri al-Maliki will win a second term as prime minister.
So it is no accident that warnings of massive election fraud have been issued by many politicians. More ominously, the vice president al-Hashimi has warned that if al-Maliki loses the election, he just might engineer a military coup d'etat.
Not great news for the American forces who are hoping to leave Iraq soon. After the last election, it took 5 months for Iraq to form a new government. Will it take longer this time? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 12th. Welcome back to New York. John, your trip to Miami, was
Miami
it good?
Was good. It was great exploring the politics in Miami. The wheels move faster in democracy in Florida than they do in Iraq, apparently.
It helps you appreciate our democracy when you see what's happening in Iraq.
Which takes us right to the morning's top news stories. A New York judge may approve a $657 million settlement today for rescue workers who became ill after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Covers more than 10,000 cops, firefighters, and construction workers, many of whom claim they suffer from respiratory illnesses and blood cancer. John Feel is a demolition expert who went to help at Ground Zero the day after the towers fell. He told CBS News this morning,
"It's an indication in a way that we're not crying wolf for the last 8.5 years. We are sick from 9/11.
As we mentioned, a judge still has to sign off on the settlement, and the rescue workers themselves have to agree.
Preliminary results from Iraq's election show a very close race, and there are fraud allegations on both sides. That was expected, though. For the latest details, we're joined by Anthony Shalid. He's the New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning.
So what are you hearing from the Iraqi people themselves about these allegations of fraud? Do they feel the election was fair?
You know, I think there was a sense even before the election that there was going to be some level of fraud. The question was how much. You know, there's still a lot of anticipation here about the results coming out, but there's also been a little bit of uncertainty the past couple of days with these allegations of fraud.
And do they expect, in the past couple of days, do they expect a clear winner to emerge?
You know, we've already seen some delays in the vote counting. Now, we had originally heard that we would have the results, at least preliminary results, which would give us a good indication of the landscape here by Wednesday or Thursday. That didn't happen. We only have very, very preliminary results, and they're impartial at that. You know, electoral officials say that we may have more complete results by next week. But one thing to remember, especially in a country like Iraq, which is often very suspicious and, you know, sometimes doubtful of what leaders are saying, the longer we wait for these results, the more you're going to hear of, questions about the integrity of the process, doubts about, the legitimacy of the results. So it could be an uncertain period in the days ahead.
Okay, Anthony Shadid, we'll be back with you in just a moment.
Democrats in Washington meeting again today to iron out differences on that health care reform bill. And President Obama says he wants it on his desk by next week, though House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that may be unlikely. The president also says he wants to move forward with his plan to overhaul the immigration system this year, but only if he can attract substantial Republican support.
And remember, unless you live in Arizona or Hawaii, you're going to lose an hour because of daylight savings time this weekend. You have to spring your clocks forward 1 hour before you go to bed on Saturday night. And that got us thinking about lost time. And we have this question for you today. What would you do if you had an extra hour every day? What do you wish you had more time for? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or our website, thetakeaway.org.
One listener said he'd give it to someone who's dying of cancer. I love that idea.
Yeah.
Asian markets mixed. European indices up. Futures up. The Dow starts at 10,611. The S&P at 1150 and the NASDAQ at 2368. It's movie day here on Friday at The Takeaway. We're going to talk about how the movie Green Zone got translated from the nonfiction book. The author will be with us. And in just a few minutes, we're going to talk about the latest in Iraq, the real Iraq, and its close election race outside of the Green Zone. That's coming up.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Well, we've gotten very preliminary results from the election in Iraq. The results we got do not include Baghdad, that accounts for 70 of the parliament's 325 seats, but they do show a very tight three-way race between the current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and the secular coalition led by former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi. Both sides are claiming fraud. Some people say that they saw ballots thrown into the garbage. Nobody knows how credible those claims are. Anthony Shadid joins us again. He's the New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. So, Anthony, how are we seeing these results falling down in this three-way split? Where are these votes coming out?
Well, you know, it's still, like you mentioned, it's still a race that's too close to call. We are seeing some results come from the south, a couple of provinces in the center of the country and the north. But to reach any conclusions off the results that have at least been made public would be really difficult at this time. We do understand from those that we've spoken to that we've seen a broader tally of these results, that the race is exceedingly close. And one thing I think you can read from that is that if that does prove to be the case, if it does bear out with the rest of the results, Prime Minister Maliki wouldn't have received the popular mandate that he hoped to have. And he may have needed that mandate to put together a coalition government that he would lead. So we may see just so far in the earliest returns, I think we're seeing that Prime Minister Maliki seems to have done, or at least to have the hardest time with what he's seeing.
We have not heard from al-Maliki since the election. He was supposedly in the hospital for surgery, and he has not been heard from since. Is that still true?
That's right. It's actually an interesting development that we've seen here over the past week. He hasn't appeared in public since the election on Sunday. We just found out yesterday in a government statement that was somewhat cryptic that he actually had undergone surgery. It turns out that he went into the hospital the day before for a two-hour operation to remove a cyst from his stomach. But again, I think this adds to the uncertainty that we've talked a little bit about. Maliki has receded from public, a very close race, too tight to call absolutely right now, and now some mounting allegations of fraud, which has definitely overcast the whole process.
Okay, we're going to talk more about that in a moment. Thanks so much, Anthony Shadid. He's the New York Times correspondent in Baghdad. And now let's turn to someone who actually voted in the election. Raed Jarar is an architect in Washington, D.C. He came here from Iraq in 2005 and carries dual passports. Good morning, Raed.
Good morning.
You cast a ballot in the election, and now that you're hearing these accusations of fraud, how seriously are you taking these accusations?
Very seriously. I have been expecting this even before the election. The Iraqi Electoral Commission is seen as partial and controlled by the current ruling parties. And unfortunately, inside and outside the country, there was a lack of international monitors this time. So I have been writing about the possibilities of fraud in the election for the last few weeks. And unfortunately, now we are hearing more and more calls of fraud that happened during the election and now during the counting process.
And in this, did you expect these kind of close results? Did you think that these divisions in the country would show up as an extremely tight race when the election results started to be counted?
Yes, I did. I think the only reason why we have these tight results is that Mr. al-Maliki ended up not running in the same coalition as Mr. Al-Hakim and the Sadrists, which are the other ruling parties. So the Al-Maliki and the other ruling parties ended up splitting the same pool of votes. I thought they will get anywhere between 23% and 25% each, and Dr. Alawi's coalition is getting around 25%. So they are running very, very close to each other. In addition to the preliminary results that started to be announced yesterday, there was an exit poll announced 2 days ago that also showed extremely clear, extremely close race between the al-Maliki's coalition and Alawi's coalition. There is less than a 2% difference between them for the overall votes all around the country.
And it could be till next week till we get an answer. That's Raed Jarar, an architect living in D.C. He voted in the Iraqi election, holds dual passports. And now let's turn to Brian Katulis. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Brian, we often see allegations of fraud. Sometimes they're called before an election has even opened and ballot boxes have started collecting ballots. How credible are these reports?
Well, Celeste, I think it's just way too early to tell. And my hope is that the institutions in Iraq can handle and deal with these allegations. We'll just have to wait and see. You know, Iraqiya, the coalition led by Alawi, has listed, I think, a pretty long list of violations, saying votes have been removed from boxes, replacement of votes in other places. But we just have to wait and see how widespread this is, because in transition elections like these, in early transitions, you often get these sorts of allegations, and my hope is that the Election Commission in Iraq will look at all these and adjudicate properly.
So far, we've heard the Western government say that they have no evidence whatsoever, no credible evidence that there was fraud. However, they were predicting beforehand that there would be not just allegations, but there would be some kind of vote tampering. What? How will we know if the vote is decisive?
Well, I think one indicator will be the domestic monitors. Raed properly said that there weren't any international monitors, and I'm just baffled as to why that did not occur. I think it was unfortunate that in these early transition elections, and this is the second full election in Iraq, they had another election for a transitional government, a third one. But I don't know why there weren't monitors, but at least there were monitors from the Iraqi side. And I think once all of the information is collected, and then importantly, when the votes are tabulated, we'll have a closer sign of whether the tabulations are a fit with what the Iraqi monitor saw or not. And again, that's going to take a matter of days, if not more weeks.
Brian Katulis, how long before we know we have a clear winner?
I think we'll probably have a sense. Well, first, there'll be no clear winner in these elections. The system is a parliamentary system with proportional representation. It's designed to promote consensus.
Brian Katulis is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thanks so much for joining us. And now it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
Oh, my God. Ya Allah. Ya Allah. Ya Allah.
Recording from a cellular phone near the site of a bomb blast in the Pakistani city of Lahore, police say at least 39 people were killed in twin suicide bomb attacks in the city, which targeted military vehicles, they suspect. At least 100 people are injured. Here in the U.S., a report on the collapse of investment bank Lehman Brothers has found that it disguised its true financial position. U.S. investigators say the bank had been insolvent for weeks before it filed for bankruptcy in September of 2008. The bankruptcy helped trigger the entire global financial crisis.
The wife of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid remains in the hospital this morning with serious injuries from a crash on an interstate near Washington yesterday. Virginia State Police spokesperson Corinne Geller describes what happened.
As the Honda Odyssey began braking for the northbound traffic, it was rear-ended by a tractor-trailer. And the impact of that crash forced the Honda Odyssey to rear-end the vehicle in front of it, which then went into the lane next to it and ran into another vehicle.
Landra Reed suffered a broken back and neck. And an atheist who charged the inclusion of the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance lost his case in a San Francisco court yesterday. He says he may appeal that to the Supreme Court. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, Virginia wants to opt out of mandated health care coverage. That's the politics going on over health care. But there's some practical legislation that could be included in health care, and it could help out students and their families. We're going to talk about that with our D.C. correspondent, Todd Zwillick, in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
of good weeks and bad weeks. That takeout is coming up in just a moment. But first, Todd Zulick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us. We've been reporting day after day that the healthcare reform bill moves closer to something looking like a vote. But all of a sudden, consumers beware. If you're applying for a student loan or enrolling in college next year, you may be part of the debate based on what they're adding on to the bill right now. Todd, what's going on?
Yeah, that's right, John. There's a move afoot in Congress among some very powerful Democrats on both sides of the Capitol to add some big education provisions to the health care bill. This is for student loans and Pell Grants for college tuition. A lot of people get about $5,000 or $5,100 a year in tuition assistance from the federal government. And Democrats have been trying all year to expand that drastically. It's a big education domestic item from the president. So the move here is to potentially put $70 billion in enhanced Pell Grants and enhanced student loans onto the health care bill. And they can do this under the rules. You know, that reconciliation gambit we've been talking about so much.
Sure.
It's actually technically not only a health care reconciliation, but there is room in there under the rules for education. Just those two things, health care and education.
Yeah. Let's talk strategy for a second. Does this gain the Democrats votes, or is it the pet project of certain lawmakers that just want to be a part of the parade?
Is the exact debate that's going on right now among Democrats. Does this help us by bringing votes from maybe liberal Democrats who don't like the health care bill, but with all this education money, they'll vote for it because they've always wanted it? Or does it hurt us by making it more unwieldy and complicated, and it's not just about health care and vulnerable to piling on more spending? So they're having that very debate right now.
Well, speaking of the does it help us or does it hurt us debate, the Virginia legislature has passed a law forbidding Virginia citizens to comply with the federal mandate should the health care reform bill pass. What's that about? And is this states' rights versus the federal government?
Yeah, this is a states' rights debate playing out in state legislatures. Virginia is the first state now to pass a bill, just as you said, John, telling people they don't have to abide by what's called the individual mandate. One of the most important parts of this health care bill is you have to get insurance. And if you can't afford it, the government will help you afford it.
Well, can Virginia do this?
Well, let me put it this way. They can pass the bill, but nobody in Congress, I went around and asked yesterday, and nobody in Congress is rushing to rewrite the bill thinking that the individual mandate will be undermined by what Virginia did. So in terms of policy, maybe not too much of a hit on the bill. I spoke to the assistant majority leader of the Senate. His name is Dick Durbin from Illinois, a Democrat, to ask if he was worried that Virginia's action would hurt the Democrats' health care bill. Listen to this.
Let me tell you how far back this debate goes. We had a civil war over this debate as to whether there's a federal government or the states can make up their own mind. We kind of decided in that war that we were one nation with a federal government, and some states still debating this. But I think it's been decided with a lot of bloodshed across America that we are one country, that there are federal laws that supersede state laws.
So do these state anti-mandate laws constitute reopening that battle, or is it just a kind of a Tea Party tactic thing?
Well, I think what it does do is reflect what state legislators think is the depth of voter discomfort and anger with the health care bill. Look, I don't think state legislators would be passing bills like this, even if they don't have any policy implication, John. I don't think they'd be doing this if they didn't think it was in their political interest to do so. So they obviously think the depth of anger is deep enough that they can pass these bills and have it be an advantage to them. There's a political implication here that we won't probably realize
but
for a while.
Being in their political interest is different from it actually being something of substance. So, Todd, you have a pretty good week this week?
Yeah, I had a great week. I spent a lot of time on the train, but it was great.
Well, you know, we always on Fridays try to see who had a good week and who had a bad week. John, you had a pretty good week with your trip to Miami.
Yeah,
but
good.
Some people didn't have so great a week.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Or should we say some songs? That's a lovely song, Simon
and
Garfunkel.
You got a vinyl copy of that in your collection there, Todd?
I have it on MP3, of course.
He probably, though, doesn't have this version of it. Nice, nice. Muzak takes
on. Going all the
on...
way down to the lobby here in the elevator. Let me press L.
But, you know, we're talking about a good week for people who don't like music, because in Oregon, this is a good week for you.
Because?
Because the state DMV canceled their subscription to the Muzak service. Now they just get safety tips when they call in and get put on hold.
It was costing them $160 a month to listen to that music.
Yeah.
Not anymore. All right, so we got to get to the bad week, right? It was a bad week, potentially, for lovers of lox with bagels. Todd, you have lox on your bagels?
Every Sunday. It's a tradition, isn't it?
Okay, there you go. Okay, so that could be a lot of people. Traditionally, Jewish smoked salmon. It's a delicacy. It goes so well with bagels and cream cheese, as we all know. But it's causing a bit of a stink with some Orthodox rabbis who claim the staple may not be up to code.
The kosher dietary law prohibits the ingestion of any living organisms, worms, flies, etc. Some rabbis, mostly out of Israel, actually, brought concerns that there may be parasites found on the flesh of the fish.
Living parasites, which makes it, okay, non-kosher. That's Rabbi Moshe Elefant. He's the chief operating officer of the Orthodox Union, the world's largest kosher certification agency. If you ever see the label OU or OU Parve on your food, salt, anything kosher, really, it's the rabbi's stamp of approval. So what does the culinary intellectual say when it comes to lox?
But this specific question about parasites found on the flesh of fish is actually not a new question, and it's been discussed by rabbis for hundreds of years, and the ruling has been and continues to be that the fish is fine.
Typically Talmudic. It could be fine, but maybe it's not fine.
They've been arguing about parasites on lox for hundreds of years.
Bad week possibly averted for all you lox fans out there. And you can actually go to the FDA website, and they give you suggestions on how to kill the live nematodes.
Salt.
That's right. Salting your fish.
If you have suggestions on who had a good week or who had a bad week in the news, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post a message on our website, thetakeaway.org. It's probably going to be a bad week if you wanted extra sleep.
Congressman Massa, don't eat any salmon, okay?
You have to set your clocks ahead an hour this weekend.
That's nasty.
Because of daylight saving time. Bad week for sleep.
Good morning. Coming up, further discussion of what's our top story in the headlines, and let's get right to them at 30 minutes after the hour. New York judge expected to approve a $657 million settlement today for rescue workers and some construction workers who became ill after the 9/11 terrorist attacks by working at Ground Zero. It covers more than 10,000 cops, firefighters, construction workers, many of whom claim they suffer from respiratory illnesses and blood cancer. The rescue workers themselves still have to agree. Why it took so long and the significance of this settlement in just a few moments. We're learning more details about the collapse of Lehman Brothers. A new report shows the investment bank used accounting gimmicks like removing $50 billion from its balance sheet, some gimmick. Senior executives then approved those misleading financial statements. And the report finds that Lehman Brothers, in effect, had been insolvent for weeks before it filed for bankruptcy in September 2008. Even though it actually existed on paper, it was insolvent in reality, and all of that helped trigger the global financial crisis.
If you're eagerly awaiting your tax refund this year, be prepared for a long wait. The recession has tied up cash and caused officials in half a dozen states to consider freezing refunds for up to 5 months. Most states typically issue refunds within 30 days, not this year. House Democrats will meet again this morning to try to iron out more of the problems on the health care bill. President Obama wants the completed bill on his desk by next week. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says
it may take longer, and we will take up the bill when we're ready to take up the bill.
That sounds like no. Even after that, though, several procedural hurdles need to be cleared, and President Obama says he's also planning to move forward with an overhaul of the immigration system this year in his spare time, once he gets some health care passed, but only if he says if Republicans are on board. And remember, if you live in unless you live in Arizona or Hawaii, we are losing an hour this weekend because of daylight saving time. The clocks are going to spring forward when you go to bed at night on Saturday. And that got us thinking about lost time, lost hours. And we have a question for you today. What would you do with an extra hour every day? What do you need more time for?
Good morning, Troy from North Dakota. With an extra hour every day, I would spend it saying yes to everything that my 3-year-old son asks me to do with him. So many times I have to turn him down when he asks me to play with him because I got to get things done, and I hate that.
Some of the things my son, you know, suggests, I'm not interested in. Like, if it's your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Saying yes for an hour.
And post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Now let's check on the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are up as the traders say yes. The Dow gets underway at 10,611. The S&P opens at 1,150 and the NASDAQ at 2,368. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
So part of Wall Street's enthusiasm there, Celeste, is retail sales are up. It just actually came across the wires. But there's some positive feeling certainly among thousands of rescue and cleanup workers who sued New York City over damaging health effects they claim they suffered as a result of conditions at the World Trade Center in the days and months after 9/11. They reached a settlement with the city, about $650 million. It would affect 10,000 plaintiffs. Joining us now is Fred Mogul, healthcare and medicine reporter for our partner WNYC Radio in New York. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, John.
And Glenn Klein is a retired NYPD officer who was at the World Trade Center on 9/11 and during the eight-month rescue and cleanup effort. You're one of the plaintiffs, right, Glenn?
That's correct.
You know, Glenn, why has this taken so long? I mean, many of us who were in New York on that day and for that entire period smelled what you smelled. We weren't as close as you, but, I mean, it certainly was never a stretch to me that that air was dangerous to breathe. Glenn?
That's a great question, and that's a question I asked last night when the city decided that they were going to try to make a settlement with us. They had 8.5 years to make this offer to us. All of a sudden, they decided that they were going to come out and make this offer to us. I don't know if you know that I'm an advocate with the Feel Good Foundation, and we've been fighting for many years for the James the Droger Act, H.R. 847, and we happen to be going to Washington on Tuesday where the bill is going to be marked up onto the floor.
Now, that bill would give specific compensation as a matter of federal law, right?
That's correct. That bill has $11 billion put aside, which would give compensation and medical coverage to 9/11 responders for the rest of their lives.
All right, so billions versus $650 million. This is still a controversy because, of course, plaintiffs are going to have to decide whether they want to accept this deal or not. Hold on there, Glenn. Fred Mogul, what are the issues facing the adoption of this settlement?
All right, so they have 90 days to decide, plaintiffs like Glenn and others, and it's not clear to me exactly yet whether they'll find their awards first and be able to make their decision. I suspect probably not, given that there's so many of them. So we know that on the low end, people who have little or no symptoms but might potentially develop them could be getting in the few thousands of dollars, and then on the high end, $1 to $2 million for people or the families of people who have died or who are terminally ill. And obviously, there's a lot of gradations in between. People worked in a lot of different capacities for a lot of different durations there, and they were exposed to a lot of different things, and they have a lot of different illnesses. And some we should say don't have illness yet, but might develop it. So there's just a lot of different things to sort out.
Now, Fred Mogul, of course, you describe quite well the complexity here, but nevertheless, there is a feeling that as long as this is taken and what seems to be an unwillingness to accept that there may have been health hazards down at Ground Zero, this all feels a little bit like Agent Orange after the Vietnam experience.
Well, there's been a lot of mixed messages from the city. The city has said, really, that this money was given to them by FEMA, $1.1 billion, just for liability, in case they're sued. The advocates say, well, that's very disingenuous. We're only suing because we need to sue. But so there's a lot of complicated liability issues with that. And the city's position has been, well, the federal government should pay for it, not as a matter of, you know, a legal defense fund, but as a matter of federal policy. And so the city, for many years, ironically, has supported the advocates' claim for some kind of legislative relief on a large scale from Capitol Hill.
So the jurisdictional questions have really slowed things down. That makes actually a lot of sense. Glenn Klein, it's certainly no surprise that NYPD officers would go into a place that is dangerous. But when did you believe, working at Ground Zero and being at Ground Zero, that this was something that could have long-term health implications?
Well, you know, what got us going on 9/11 and the months after is our adrenaline and knowing that not only were our fellow officers and firefighters buried in the rubble, there were also innocent victims that were buried in there. We wanted to bring them home to the family members, and regardless of whether we knew the air was going to be bad to breathe, we knew we had a job to do, and we were going to do it either way. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to know that the green fumes and colors that you've never seen before that were spewing out of the debris and the thick gobs of dust and particles we're going to be good for you.
But Glenn, does the fact that you and you know it's heroic that you say this, you would have done it anyway. Does that limit your claim? Because people are likely to say, hey, he didn't care about his own health. He was emotionally involved in the situation. What do you say to that?
No, I don't think so, because we stepped up. We went above and beyond the call of duty. I think the city is still liable, and the government was still liable to supply us with the proper equipment. The EPA also came out and told us that the air quality was okay to breathe.
I remember
that.
So we
were misled also.
Well, $650 million, that's the settlement. You're going to take it, Glenn?
It's too early to say. I don't think so. As I said, you're talking about people who are really, really sick. I mean, I'm fortunate that I'm not as sick as some of the others who have cancer. If you give a cancer victim $1 million or even $2 million, how far does that go?
Yeah, well, it's a lot to think about, and you got some time to think about it. The plaintiffs are contemplating the $650 million or more settlement for the Ground Zero workers. Fred Mogul, healthcare reporter for WNYC, and Glenn Klein, retired NYPD officer. Thanks to both of you.
What you're hearing is the sounds of drums and protesters at a ritual ceremony in Thailand. It's marking the start of a planned protest that's due to take place over the weekend in the capital city of Bangkok. Anti-government protesters are gathering the provinces, and they're going to make their way towards Bangkok for a mass rally that's planned on Sunday. The government, in response, as in Thailand, has mobilized about 40,000 security personnel, and the protesters are mainly supporters of the former prime minister who was ousted in a military coup in 2006. To get more details on this, we spoke earlier with Vodine England, a BBC reporter in Bangkok, and she filled us in on who these protesters are and what they want.
We call them the red shirts, unsurprisingly, because they wear red shirts. Many of them are supporters of the former prime minister, Thaksin Shinawat. Many of them are also more than that, though. They say they want social change in Thailand, and they want their vote to count. So they're angry, at the very least, about the fact that Mr. Thaksin was deposed in a military coup. So they're grouped under an organization that's called the UDD. They have branches right across the country. They've been holding sort of political education seminars and rallies and entertainment sessions. And they are all gathering and, as you say, coming to town. They have originally said that they were planning this to be a million-man march. Now, that has been downgraded to something more like maybe 500,000 at the most, which is still, of course, a very large number of people. We're not seeing anything like that yet. A few thousand have made it to Bangkok, holding that ceremony that we heard sound from earlier, to bless the beginning of their demonstration. But it's not actually meant to happen until Sunday, and so we'll find out then if they even pass their basic goal of at least 100,000 people, maybe more.
And we've heard that the government is mobilizing 40,000 security personnel. Are there going to be clashes, do we expect?
Well, if you have that many people around on the streets and you've had a political schism going on for at least 3.5 years, then there is, of course, a possibility that things could get out of hand. They did almost a year ago, when the Red Shirts actually prevented a major regional summit from taking place in Thailand, and the subsequent clampdown saw two people dead. Since then, the Red Shirt movement has been very firm in saying that we are a peaceful movement. There is no intent to have any violent incident at all. And only time will tell, of course, if that is what happens. There's all sorts of conspiracy theories. Is the government beating up the chance of violence to justify a crackdown? Are the Reds pretending that they're peaceful when they're not? Who will know?
And is there any chance they're going to get the new elections that they're asking for?
Perhaps not immediately, but certainly in the near future, in the next year or so, this current government will probably feel the need to prove its legitimacy at the ballot box.
That was Vodine England, BBC reporter in Thailand, talking about protests that are planned there for Sunday. You know what else is happening on Sunday, John?
No.
Daylight saving time.
Oh, you've mentioned that.
Spring forward. You have to reset your clock. Don't forget, because you need to be here on time on Monday.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, we're asking...
I'll just sleep through the first hour of the show.
We're asking our listeners today, what would you do if you had more time? I mean, what would you do with an extra hour a day? What would you do, John?
I would age.
You're doing that well already. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
That's mean.
No, that I said you're aging well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. John Huckenberry with Celeste Headlee here. Big movie this week, Matt Damon's Green Zone. It's an Iraq war thriller. We're going to talk about it in just a moment in our movie segment. But thinking of war movies, we have a trivia question for you or two. What leading actor portrayed someone wounded in Afghanistan and then recovered only to be stronger, way stronger than ever before? Name the actor and the movie. And this lead actress's character in a Denzel Washington movie was dead during the entire picture. Think about it now. Name the movie and the actress. We'll give you the answers in just a few moments. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. As we mentioned a few minutes ago, the latest retail sales figures are out. They show a 0.3% increase last month. The Associated Press says the figure is surprising, raises hopes the economy may be gaining some momentum. Judge in New York will consider a settlement involving thousands of rescue and recovery workers who were sickened by dust from the destroyed World Trade Center on 9/11. The deal could give those workers as much as $657 million to split, with most or all of that money coming out of a federal grant.
Yesterday, we told you about a senior prom that was canceled in Mississippi after a lesbian student was told she could not take her girlfriend to the dance. Today, we find out that the student in question is now suing her school district over the issue. This morning, Constance McMillan spoke to CBS News.
It's like they're asking you, like, for prom, you can be gay, just don't be openly gay. Just hide it for a little while.
American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit on behalf of the 18-year-old. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
So on Friday, it is all about the movies and dinner and a movie, perhaps, but maybe not with this movie. Today, the new Iraq war movie, Green Zone, hits theaters nationwide.
We got to go get our prisoner back. Find this guy, Al-Rawi.
Let Bethel handle it, please.
No, Bethel can't see past the files on his desk.
So what? You're going to ring the doorbell now and ask Special Forces
to
handle it?
No, I'm going to use the book and trade up and get some help.
What are you talking about?
Jerry, why do we keep coming up empty on all these sites?
Chief, we're here to do a job and get home safe. That's all. The reasons don't matter.
They matter to me.
Green Zone reteams Matt Damon and his Bourne Identity director Paul Greengrass. It's inspired by the best-selling book Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, which was written by Rajiv Chandrasekharan, who happens to be with us today. Good morning, Rajiv.
Good to be with you.
And also with us, of course, Takeaway movie contributor and Newsday writer Rafer Guzman. He's seen Green Zone and lots of other Iraq war movies. And to both of you, you know, with Green Zone, we're really seeing, in a sense, a kind of capstone to an entire genre of films that began with sort of the conspiratorial, what's going on kind of movies like Syriana, moved through movies like The Messenger, The Hurt Locker, which are point of view American soldier, to this kind of Bourne Identity thriller Inside the Green Zone. Rajiv, first of all, what do you think of what Hollywood did to your book?
Well, I think they've made a really wonderful action-driven thriller here. You know, they've certainly have not directly adapted the book. The book inspired a screenplay that was written for this movie. But they've created a movie that really has kept me sitting on the edge of my seat the number of times I've seen it.
So it sounds like he likes the movie. Rafer Guzman?
I was not super crazy about the film, although I think it was pretty interesting in the way that it very directly maps out the run-up to the Iraq War. And I thought that was interesting to see in an action flick. You know, almost every single person that we know, every key player that we remember from the run-up to the Iraq War has a counterpart of some part in here. There's an Ahmed Chalabi character. There's a Judith Miller-type character. There's a sort of a Rumsfeld-esque character played by Greg Kinnear. Almost every single person has got some kind of representation in the film.
Nevertheless, Rajiv, does that mean this is a policy film in any sense, that it's critical of U.S. actions or coalition actions?
Well, I certainly think it is intended to get the moviegoer to re-engage with some of those issues regarding the decision to go to war in Iraq. It's not a straight-up policy movie. It's done in the style of the other movies that Paul Greengrass is very much known for, the Bourne series of movies, where he takes an action plot and weaves in political messages. And that's, I think, what this movie's trying to do. You've got a storyline here, but here and there and throughout it, the moviegoer is confronted with some of these bigger issues.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran is the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, the book that the new movie Green Zone is based on. You know, Rafer Guzman, a Takeaway movie contributor and movie critic for Newsday, I'm surprised at how rich a genre the Iraq War has been, given some of the political issues in the United States. Listen to this.
How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure.
Sergeant.
Yes.
Ask your question.
873.
873. 873. What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
That's a good one.
Great scene from Hurt Locker, David Morris and Jeremy Renner there. You know, I lived through the whole Vietnam film era as pretty much an adult. And I remember when the first Vietnam film started coming out, it was as though an entire box was being opened. This was something unrevealed, unexamined by Hollywood. Iraq has been examined by Hollywood, it seems, whether you're talking about successfully or not in terms of box office, almost from the beginning. What's different, Rafer?
I think what's different about it is that we are, as a country, we are not all on the same page about this war. And I think that is one of the reasons that these films tend not to do that well at the box office. By the time that the Iraq War movies really came pouring out, Coming Home, Apocalypse Now, the Deer Hunter, movies like that.
And but then after that, the whole Rambo kind
sure,
of
Platoon,
booster movies.
Yeah, Rambo, sure. By the time those movies came out, Vietnam was over. We'd had some time to process it, and I think we'd all as a country had come to agree that it was a debacle.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, you're a journalist, of course, for The Washington Post. We're Baghdad bureau chief for a while, now reporting on Afghanistan. Do you sense that movie directors are getting some of the blowback that you as a journalist received when you were reporting on Iraq and now in Afghanistan?
I think there's no doubt that for quite a while, Iraq has been an incredibly controversial subject, not just for those of us engaged in daily journalism, but those involved in feature filmmaking. I think, though, that perhaps we're moving into a new phase with regard to Iraq. Casualty rates are at some historical lows there. There is a perception that things have turned the corner there. And I think we may be moving into a period where the broader American public may be willing to engage with the subject of Iraq in a different way from the past several years.
Well, we'll see if Green Zone actually makes any money here. Rafer Guzman, is Hollywood engaged in the first draft of history in Iraq and Afghanistan, unlike what went on in Vietnam?
It's possible. It's possible that it is. I think it's just been very difficult so far, at least, for filmmakers to take some kind of a stand. I think it's been very difficult for filmmakers to say, to come down on one side or the other, and so they tend to focus more on the part that we can all agree on, which is the personal tragedy of the war. This movie, Green Zone, I will say, is the first movie I've seen in terms of a Hollywood action film to come out and pretty pointedly say, hey, everyone, your government lied to you and wasted lives. That's pretty interesting to me.
Well, Green Zone, see it and decide for yourself. Matt Damon, Born Identity director Paul Greengrass, inspired by Rajiv Chandrasekaran's book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. Rajiv, thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure to talk to you today.
And thanks, of course, as always, to Rafer Guzman, film contributor to The Takeaway and movie critic for Newsday.
Where's Miller?
He's moving northwest towards Adamia.
ETA?
12 minutes.
ETA, 12 minutes.
So with Green Zone and War Pictures on the mind, and Rafer wanted no part of these trivia questions, let's give you the answers. Trivia question number one. What leading actor portrayed someone wounded in Afghanistan and then recovered only to be much, much, much stronger than ever before? Name the actor in the movie.
Strong as Iron.
Good hint. Ding, ding. Robert Downey Jr. in Iron Man.
Is it cool if I take a picture with you?
Yes, it's very cool.
Please, no gang signs.
Yeah, peace. I love peace. I'd be out of a job with peace.
And the second question. The lead actress in a Denzel Washington movie was dead during the entire picture. Name the movie and the actress.
I would never have gotten this one. No.
This is a good movie.
I didn't see it.
Courage Under Fire with Meg Ryan.
I am in command here.
Well, maybe not anymore.
Give me the saw, Monfreys.
You're not taking away my weapon.
Mutiny. An offense punishable by death.
Eve was so great in that movie, Courage Under Fire.
I'd be interested if any of our listeners got that. As your weekend starts, many of you go see movies, but remember, you have one less hour in which to do it because daylight saving time this Sunday. You got to spring your clocks 1 hour ahead before you go to bed on Saturday night. And this whole concept has got us thinking about time, and we have this question for you today. What do you wish you had more time for? There's a theme actually going on with some of our listeners. Helen says, I would write. As a full-time mom, part-time engineer, and aspiring writer, I find writing time is what gets squeezed out every day. And Tamika says, I definitely need more time to work on my new novel and obsess about the first one attracting a literary agent who can sell it. Tell us about your great American novel at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org.
And at thetakeaway.org, you can choose a T-shirt slogan. We're going to make a T-shirt of your six-word or less slogan. You know how to do it. Find us at thetakeaway.org/T-shirt. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.